And we are rolling. Hi, David.
Hey, Mark. How are you doing?
Good. So this is Mark Goldberg with the UN and Global Affairs blog, UN Dispatch, speaking with David Bosco, author of the new book, fresh from Oxford University Press. And I'm holding the book in front of the camera right now, David. It's Five to Rule Them All, the UN Security Council and the Making of the Modern World. And, you know, this is a very timely book, given events of last week, but we're going to, you know, plunge into a discussion of your book, of the Security Council, its histories, its successes, its failures, and, you know, what you think its significance is in sort of the greater, architecture of international institutions and, you know, international peace and security. So thank you, first of all, for writing a great book.
No, thank you for having me on. It sounds like a full agenda for today's discussion.
It is, and all within, you know, the half-hour confines of blogging heads. You know, maybe I wanted to, you know, I do want to discuss contemporary issues, but I was hoping, you know, maybe you can maybe set the scene a little bit for us by, you know, I guess just briefly describing sort of the origins of the Security Council.
Right.
Sort of who thought of it, where it came from,
yeah.
Why is it here today?
Well, you know, this was the kind of closing days of World War II, and there was a consensus among the three major allied powers, the United States, the UK, and the Soviet Union, but particularly the United States and the UK, that in the wake of this, you know, horrific war, there had to be some kind of global organization set up. So much the same as there had been after the First World War, the consensus that, you know, the world had to figure out some way to govern itself. That was kind of the consensus coming out of World War II. Now, interest in this organization, I would say, was much stronger in the U.S. and in the U.K. than it was in the Soviet Union. And I'll talk a little bit about, you know, Stalin's particular take on it. But there was this conundrum in the sense that they wanted to create a universal organization, but they also wanted a special place for themselves. They wanted a special place for the great powers, and that was how this division between the Security Council and the General Assembly emerged. And it kind of followed the template of the League of Nations with some important differences. And they negotiated that, you know, what became the Security Council and what became the UN at Dumbarton Oaks, in D.C. And there were some changes made at the San Francisco Conference. But that was really the genesis of the Security Council. Now, there was this question of who else do you put on the Security Council? Because much as the big three, I think, would have liked to keep it just the big three, they realized that that probably wouldn't fly in the rest of the world. So they decided to add France and China as permanent members, and then to have a certain number of rotating members from the unwashed masses, so to speak, come onto the council for rotating two-year terms.
Mm-hmm. To sort of give it the patina of international legitimacy?
Yeah, I mean, I think they realized, you know, at some point we're going to actually have to introduce this this organization that we're creating to the rest of the world, and we need the rest of the world to have some access to this Security Council, because they were imagining a body that would have enormous power, really. Mm-hmm. And it does, to this day, have enormous power.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like, you know, you could break up the history of the Security Council, of the UN in general, into sort of maybe three stages. There's that initial stage that you described. Then there was, you know, the entire Cold War era,
right,
where there was, you know, as you described, a sense of paralysis.
Yeah.
At the Security Council, and then, you know, the post-Cold War era that we're living in now.
Yeah.
What are some, you know, some highlights from your book from this great long Cold War era of the Security Council?
Yeah, and I think one thing I try to do in the book a little bit is to kind of resuscitate the Cold War history, revive the Cold War history of the UN, because I do think, as you say, there is this sense that the UN was simply paralyzed, particularly the Security Council was paralyzed during the Cold War, which in many respects is true. I mean, there were, you know, frequent Soviet vetoes in the beginning, and the United States started vetoing quite a few resolutions in the early 1970s. And so on many important questions, it was paralyzed. But I also do think that the Security Council played a pretty important role in a couple of crucial crises during the Cold War. And I talk in the book about the Berlin blockade of 1948, when, in essence, the United States and the Soviet Union kind of negotiated their way out of that very dangerous crisis on the margins of a Security Council meeting, with their Security Council ambassadors being the key interlocutors. I talk also about the 1967 and 1973 wars, which, you know, I think it's often forgotten. That's the kind of conflict that a lot of people thought would ignite a U.S.-Soviet conflict, and there was a danger of escalation in both of those cases. But the United States and the Soviets used the Security Council basically as a mechanism for pulling themselves back from the brink. They used ambiguous Security Council resolutions as a way to kind of call for a ceasefire without resolving the key issues on the ground. And, you know, as you look at the history of that, of both of those conflicts, you see the Security Council right at the center of things. Mm-hmm. And I think playing from the standpoint of avoiding a U.S.-Soviet confrontation, a very helpful role. Mm-hmm. Less helpful in terms of resolving the underlying dispute in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. See, I guess what's interesting, you know, your book sort of pushes against conventional wisdom in that respect, and that, you know, the conventional wisdom being, you know, the U.N., there was just sort of paralysis at the Council.
Right. Right.
But it seems to me, you know, one of the central arguments of your book is that, you know, the Security Council as just a forum, as a meeting place, is sort of an end in and of itself. That,
yes.
That itself is sort of inherently valuable, even if, you know, the outcomes aren't, you know, immediately apparent.
Right, right. And I try to distinguish in the book between what I call the concert role of the Security Council, basically the ability of the Council to help the big powers navigate, manage relations among themselves, and the governance role, which is kind of saying, all right, how has the Security Council solved X, Y, and Z problems out there in the world? The Middle East crisis being a perfect example. And I think the Council throughout its history has been much more effective as this kind of loose concert of the big powers, helping keep them on the same page on a lot of issues, helping them extricate themselves from difficult situations. And it's been quite poor throughout its history at this governance role.
Mm-hmm. So you gave me some highlights from the Cold War era, post Cold War era. What you know, I guess what sticks out to you about the Security Council, you know, in sort of managing, you know, what is, you know, a sort of a transition in sort of global power sharing and global roles.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting features of the post-Cold War period, particularly when you look at, you know, U.S.-UN relations, is that if you had to pick one person who was kind of responsible for vaulting the Security Council back to the center of world politics, you'd have to say it was George H.W. Bush. Because faced with the crisis of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, George H.W. Bush decided to make the Security Council the centerpiece of its diplomatic effort. And that wasn't at all, I think, inevitable. And in fact, Margaret Thatcher, a key ally, pushed against that and said, look, are you sure, George, that you want to do this, that you want to make the Security Council such a centerpiece, because you may come to regret that later. But, you know, he felt like, no, this is an institution I'm comfortable with. You know, he'd served there as an ambassador. I think we can work through it effectively, and he did. He and his ambassador, Tom Pickering, and the Secretary of State at the time, James Baker, really turned the Security Council into something approaching a governance mechanism. You know, it was passing sanctions. It was kind of being involved at every phase of the diplomacy as regarded the Iraq-Kuwait situation. And that, in turn, launched this effort, which we saw in the early 1990s, to have the Security Council really take on all these problems around the world that had been kind of festering. So you see, you know, peacekeeping missions launched in Cambodia, Namibia. Of course, launch a very, the Security Council authorizes a hugely ambitious mission to Somalia. You have peacekeepers in Bosnia. So this is really a moment where the Security Council tries to turn itself into some kind of rudimentary kind of governing mechanism for the world security. And of course, there's a huge backlash and a huge collapse, in a sense, with the Somalia operation in Bosnia being the most notable examples of that. And I think now we're in kind of a post-euphoria period of the Cold War, where people realize this is an important institution. but they also realize there's some real limitations on what it can do. So I think we're in that kind of purgatory right now.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, into this, you know, what you describe as purgatory steps what seems to be a more fulsome embrace of not just the UN, but the council in particular by the Obama administration. Last week in New York, unprecedented, the president held chaired a Security Council meeting on non-proliferation and disarmament. And we're recording this on Wednesday, September 30th, and in New York as we speak, the Secretary of State is chairing a Security Council meeting on women in armed conflict.
Right.
And I guess what do you see sort of coming out? What do you see are the roots of the administration's seeming embrace of the council, and what do you see as coming out of that?
Well, there are two strong strains in American thought. There's as regards international organizations, there is kind of the idealistic strain, which says, you know, we should lead these organizations. We can turn them into valuable tools that can really change the nature of international relations. And I think the Obama administration is very much kind of on that side of the divide. The other side of it, of course, being the very skeptical, almost to sometimes paranoid view of international organizations, that they're trying to take away American sovereignty, take away American freedom of action. But I think, in a sense, the Obama administration's embrace of the UN not only reflects its adherence to the former strain of thought, but also the very salient, what it took to be the very salient lesson of the second Bush administration. There, of course, is the feeling on the left in the United States that the United States ignored the UN and paid a price, and that a lot of what happened, you know, in terms of the Iraq conflict, can be, you know, is a result of the United States kind of turning its back on the international community and the UN in particular. And that's why when Susan Rice, the new U.S. ambassador, gave a big speech in New York recently, she said, you know, we've paid the price for stiff-arming the UN, and now we're going to, you know, we're going to re-engage, we're going to embrace it. So I think that's what's going on, and that's why you see the Obama administration, you know, making sure to get the president, you know, out there chairing a meeting, having the Secretary of State chairing a meeting. I have some skepticism that they're going to be able to achieve what they hope to achieve. But certainly in terms of recognizing the value of this institution, to my mind, this is a good thing.
Hmm. Well, let's probe your skepticism. That seems like a fun experiment. What do you see as their goals?
Right.
And sort of why do you think that, you know, they cannot achieve said goals through, you know, their sort of embrace of the council, specifically the UN more generally?
Well, and it goes back to, you know, my view of the Security Council as a whole, which is that anything that comes out of the Security Council is going to be a lowest common denominator kind of compromise between the big powers. That's just the reality of it. And so when it comes to issues like Iran or North Korea or Sudan, which, you know, particularly the former two are very much at the top of the administration's agenda, you have to say, okay, what are the interests of the five permanent players on the Security Council? And, you know, there's been some good reporting on this in the last couple days in the New York Times in particular, about how Russia and China see, for example, the question of Iran. And they simply see it through a very different prism. They see it in terms of economic relations, in terms of energy relations. I think probably Beijing and Moscow are not thrilled about Iran getting a nuclear weapon, but for them it's a much lesser concern than some of these other issues. And so, you know, you put those very different priorities into a room, you know, the Security Council, and you let people hash it out, and I think what's going to come out is some kind of lowest common denominator. We'll probably get another round of sanctions against Iran. I don't think it'll be the kind of crippling sanctions that might be necessary to really change the regime's mind. Similarly, on North Korea, I mean, in essence, they've already gone nuclear. I do not imagine that the Security Council will be able to produce anything that would cause them to abandon their program.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we talk about a humanitarian situation like Sudan, a complex political problem. Again, you've got fundamentally different interests involved, and there, you know, with China in particular, simply not wanting to kind of isolate and punish the Sudanese regime. And so I'm skeptical as well that there will be much of a change in terms of the Security Council's performance on those issues.
Getting back to the question of sanctions, one thing that I always, sort of not struggle with, but sort of think about when looking at this issue of sanctions are necessarily sort of a lowest common denominator affair, where, you have to, keep, trading down until you reach a level where everyone can sign on to it.
Right.
But, at the same time, it seems like there is a degree of value in unanimity that, while the economic effect of a sanction might not be significant, there's, the sort of political show of force is significant, that you're showing, a world united.
Yeah, I don't discount that entirely, and I certainly hope that, the show of, the five permanent members and the other members of the Security Council passing some new resolution with some additional sanctions, I hope that would have a major effect in Tehran. But remember, there's going to be an alternative message, a kind of subtler message, which is that there's going to be this long process of negotiation, and there's going to be, as you say, a ratcheting down, a kind of getting to the lowest common denominator. And I think that in its own way will signal to Tehran that, look, Moscow and Beijing have your back in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, there is the value of the united message, but that's not the only message that's going to be coming out of the Security Council deliberations.
Also looking at, events of the last, week and a half, one thing that struck me and stuck out was the sort of near ubiquity of China at these events. And this was the first time that a Chinese president, participated so fulsomely in all these events surrounding UN Week, and that included, the Security Council meeting, chaired by Obama, attended by, Hu Jintao. I'm wondering sort of what you see, looking back historically, as China's sort of evolving role at the UN, at least since, the current seat that is held by China has been held since 1971.
Right.
I'm wondering if you can, getting back to your book a little bit, if you can explain sort of why, China has only held this seat since 1971, and then sort of how their role has shifted and changed in the Security Council.
Yeah, it's a really, it's such an interesting element of Security Council politics. The position of the United States, and it kind of coerced some of its allies on this, from, the late 1940s up through the early 1970s, was that Taiwan was a legitimate representative of China. And every year, almost, there would be a vote in the General Assembly where some communist bloc country would try to unseat the delegation from Taipei and say, no, it has to be the delegation from, from the mainland. And every year, the State Department would go into hyperdrive trying to collect votes to defeat this resolution. And it got harder and harder over the years as it became more and more absurd to people that, Taiwan held China's seat. And so finally, with the Nixon-Kissinger diplomacy, you get the breaking point where the United States kind of signals, not explicitly, but signals that it's, it's willing to see a change on this issue of UN representation. The U.S. tried to actually get a seat for Taiwan as well, a General Assembly seat for Taiwan as well, but that fell by the wayside because the position of both mainland China and Taiwan was that there's only one China. And so, this idea of dual seats never really took off. So China, communist China, mainland China, takes the seat in the early 1970s. One of the interesting things about their involvement in Security Council deliberations is how reticent they've been, in a sense. The Chinese, over the years, have turned, abstention on the Security Council into a high art form. They have abstained more than any other power. They really dislike being isolated on the council. Now, there are a few issues on which they're willing to be isolated. There are some, anything that touches on Taiwan at all, they'll be willing to deploy the veto, anything that they think, you know, is really about their kind of sovereignty. But for the most part, they like to get along. They will abstain rather than veto if it comes down to it. So I think it'll be interesting on Iran, just jumping to current issues. My own sense is that Russia is going to be the key on Iran, because I think China will tend to follow Russia's lead. That's not the case, however, on North Korea, where I think China considers itself to be, you know, the lead player. So there, I think they'll be very much marking out their own course. But I think overall, in terms of the Security Council, one of the interesting features is that we've started to see in the last 5 or 10 years China emerging as a global player on the council. It, you know, diplomats that I spoke to, and I interviewed, I think, 60 or 70 diplomats who'd served on the Security Council. Many of those who'd worked with Chinese diplomats in the 70s, 80s, even into the 90s, described them as a regional power. You know, they saw everything as a regional power, and were content to follow the West's lead on quite a number of issues. That's changing now. I think they see themselves much more as a global player, and they're also just, in terms of their diplomatic representation, I think they're starting to be more effective at the UN. When I interviewed John Bolton for the book, he talked about how he saw a very marked difference in Chinese representation from his time in the first Bush administration to his service in the second Bush administration. You know, he said that Chinese diplomats were more prepared, they spoke better English, more engaged. So I think that's definitely one of the trends in terms of Security Council politics, is the emergence of China diplomatically.
I guess that that insight and your raising of John Bolton makes me wonder. So I guess, to what extent do you think the personality of individual diplomats, of individual perm reps, from the P5 countries, to what extent do you think that influences the sort of work of the Security Council, the conduct? Or are these people just, you know, receiving instructions from Beijing, Moscow, right, Washington?
Right.
Or does their, you know, personal style, does their fluency in certain languages, affect the outcome, any sort of significant outcomes, of issues before the council?
Yeah, and I do try to, in the book, I talk a bit and try to introduce some of the personalities that have served on the council. I think it very much depends on the issue that's before the council, because one way that council diplomacy will work is that, you know, you simply have ambassadors, perm reps, getting their instructions from their capitals and reporting that to the other ambassadors. And, you know, if that's the case, you obviously wouldn't expect the personalities of the perm reps to make much of a difference. But that is not the only way that Security Council diplomacy works. Often there's kind of both, instructions being received from capitals, but also feedback from the perm reps about what's possible, what possible room for negotiation there might be. And on some issues, the capitals, I think, kind of delegate to the perm reps and say, look, you guys hammer out the details. And so on those kinds of issues, certainly I think the personality of the perm rep matters. And, a lot of the non-U.S. diplomats that I spoke to cited Thomas Pickering as an example of this was the first Bush's UN ambassador.
And I can interrupt you here briefly. He's also a repeat guest on this very program.
Very good.
Always insightful. Pickering.
No, so, insightful, so, and really a remarkable diplomat. And, you know, so ambassadors that I spoke to from other countries cite, you know, Pickering as kind of a master of the backroom compromise at the UN. Because, you know, remember, the Security Council only meets in the formal chamber when it's ready basically to pass some kind of resolution or make some kind of statement. The really hard work is all done behind the scenes, either in the consultation room where the full council meets, or in different rooms where, you know, the P5 might sit together, or different kind of coalitions within the council will meet. And, you know, when it comes down to that kind of head-to-head, struggling over wording, struggling to figure out what kind of formulation can work, the personalities do matter. They do matter. I mean, they're not gonna move a country in a direction that they wouldn't otherwise go. But a lot of issues, are left to the perm reps in terms of substantial parts of the negotiation. It'll be interesting. I would guess that any kind of resolution new resolution on Iran is something that'll be drafted more from capitals than from New York. Mm-hmm. But again, that it also depends on the relationship between the perm rep and the Secretary of State. And we have an interesting case here in Susan Rice and Hillary Clinton.
So let's elaborate. I'm curious. What's your take on their relationship?
Well, I don't know much about their relationship, but certainly the dynamic, if you look back at the history of U.S. perm reps and U.S. secretaries of state, is that there's ample room for tension.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think, you know, Pickering, apparently, you know, James Baker really was annoyed with him at times, I think, because he was getting a lot of publicity. Adlai Stevenson had, you know, clashes with the Secretary of State. Henry Cabot Lodge, back under Eisenhower, a couple times kind of basically refused to take instructions from the State Department.
That's funny. And in John Bolton's memoir, he describes, you know, pretty tense relationship between he and Rice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go on.
And the U.S. has kind of exacerbated this tension by making the perm rep often a cabinet-level position, which... frankly, I doubt the wisdom of that, although I like it in the sense that it kind of elevates the UN, you know, which I think is a valuable institution. It also has this negative bureaucratic effect of making it seem as if there are two different voices on U.S. diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, technically, even though, you know, a Secretary of State is a cabinet rank, the U.S.
Yeah.
Ambassador is a cabinet rank, you know, the chain of reporting still goes, you know, from the UN, from the U.S. mission at the UN to the State Department, and then up through the chain.
Yeah, and you have the Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizations, who I think often finds herself in a difficult position.
Right, because she would sort of technically outranks the UN ambassador,
exactly.
But, you know, in sort of the reporting chain, but not in reality.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it's a very it's a situation kind of designed for tension, and then you throw in the fact that Susan Rice was a top Obama campaign advisor, and, well, Hillary Clinton, we know, you know, her story. So we'll see. I haven't heard suggestions that there's a lot of tension right now, but given the history of relations between perm reps and secretaries of state and the particular dynamics here, it wouldn't shock me to see that emerge as a tension.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to, you know, the always discussed, you know, issue when talking about the Security Council is expansion.
Yeah.
Will it happen? Should it happen? How might it happen? Do you think it is wise to happen?
Right.
I'll let you, you know, I'm sure you have a ready-made riff on Security Council expansion, but I will serve it up to you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, in my view of the council, the idea that that it's best as a concert of the big power, or most effective as a concert of the big powers and kind of least effective as a governance mechanism, very much shapes my view on expansion. And that is that I'm skeptical of it. Not so much expansion per se, but the way it would almost certainly happen because of the political realities. I think in my ideal world, I would try to push Britain and France to create a EU seat and free up a seat, which, you know, this is really kind of, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin here. But I would try to push them to take an EU seat. I would add Japan. I would add Brazil and India to the Security Council as permanent members.
This is like David's fantasy council.
Yes, exactly. This is my dream Security Council.
Yes.
Because I think the Security Council's value is that it represents power. It should accurately represent power. And you want the biggest, most important powers there. So that's one, you know, change that I would make. The problem is, in terms of as you well know, in terms of practical politics at the UN, we're talking about an amendment to the UN Charter, which means you've got to get 2/3 of the General Assembly. And the General Assembly will insist that if you're going to add particularly as many as 3 or 4 permanent seats, you've got to add 5, 10 rotating seats. So that the General Assembly, the broader membership of the UN, can have more ready access, more input into the Security Council. And then suddenly you wake up and you look and you're at a Security Council of 25 or 30 members. And I just worry that at that point, it's no longer a conducive forum for big power diplomacy. I mean, already on a lot of issues, I think, you know, things aren't done through the Security Council, they're done through other fora. But I would just imagine that at 25 or 30 members, it's just too unwieldy. Mm-hmm. And then, in a sense, you've kind of lost this value that I try to identify in the book. And so that's my concern about expansion.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess my take is very similar to yours in that, you know, it seems like it's a worthy endeavor to strive for.
Yeah.
Yeah, for values, you know, of equality and you know, trying to, you know, make you know, the council reflect, you know, 21st century realities. But you know, as you described, we have created, you know, this very unique institution that, despite its flaws, does, you know, have, you know, add a lot of value,
yeah,
to international relations.
Yeah.
I know we're running out of time, but I wanted to give you one last chance. I'm holding up your book again to plug your book. Any sort of enticing stories, anecdotes, anything from your book that you might want to cite, highlight, discuss to well, tease viewers into purchasing it.
Well, it is really a reported history of the Security Council, although it does have this, you know, this kind of thesis about the council built into it. But really, it's a reported history. I wanted to give people a sense of what the council's been like and the personalities. Just a couple of possible anecdotes of interest. There's a lot of backstory that I have in there to the famous Adlai Stevenson speech. You know, this is probably the most iconic moment in the Security Council's history, where Adlai Stevenson, you know, confronts Ambassador Zorin of the Soviet Union about the Cuban missiles. And in researching that, I hadn't realized how fraught the preparation of that speech was. Stevenson had, of course, been burned during the Bay of Pigs when he'd kind of gone before the UN and said the U.S. wasn't involved, and even held up photographs purporting to show that it was Cuban exiles. And so he came into the whole Cuban Missile Crisis very skeptical of U.S. intelligence and skeptical of the CIA. And so Kennedy basically had to send up people to kind of brief Adlai Stevenson and convince him to make the case. Moreover, in Washington, there was a lot of doubt about whether Adlai Stevenson was the right guy to make the case to the Security Council, because they worried that he didn't have the backbone. And so they sent John McCloy, who was kind of a veteran troubleshooter, up to New York to kind of be there in case Stevenson kind of crumbled under the pressure or whatever. And also that very famous speech that he gave, there was in the moments before the Security Council met that day, there was a lot of back and forth between Washington and New York about what exactly should be on that speech. And at one point, Stevenson kind of stalked off to the Security Council chamber, refusing to take a call from President Kennedy about what the speech should include. So there's a lot of backstory on that. There's also in the book a recounting of some of the testiness between the British ambassador and the U.S. ambassador who during the Bosnia crisis. And that was Madeleine Albright on the U.S. side and David Hannay on the British side. And there's in there a kind of a sharp nickname that Hannay gave for Albright during those moments when tension between the U.S. and the U.K. was very high. I won't give that nickname because you know, people have to buy the book.
Okay, and you're teasing us. Well, thank you very much, David.
Thanks very much, Mark. I appreciate it.
Great, and you know, it's on shelves, and you know, look forward to, you know, hopefully folks read it and enjoy.